Okay, are we live?
Yep.
Okay, first order, call to order. Second order of business, conflict of interest or disclosure, to everyone. And my disclosure is primarily twofold. One, I also serve on a county commission allocating the bid tax. I had a number of meetings during the month with the Paulsboro Police Department, their chief, district attorney, primarily on dealing with mental health advocacy. It's an issue that tangentially impacts the police department because of the social service. Also, I had many contacts during the month with one community member, former member of this commission, dealing primarily with services with mentally ill.
It's Rob Killian, no conflicts of interest, no intermediate communications.
Trenton Bird, nothing to report.
Kathy Dunn, no conflicts of interest.
Dan Reisfeld, nothing to report.
Okay, I would go to our next agenda item, a public comment, but we have no public members present to comment, so we'll hold that item until somebody does appear. Next is to approve the regular meeting minutes from our last meeting. I know Amber sent them out by email, and we made one correction. Has everyone had a chance to look them over, and are any other corrections? And we'll entertain a motion.
I so move.
I said.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Okay, minutes are approved. New business, dismissal of the Yates appeal hearing. Required?
Yes, so basically we have to take, or the commission has to take official action. So just to kind of sum up, this was in the packet, but I did receive an email from Mr. Yates dismissing his, or basically withdrawing his appeal after he received information from the city attorney indicating the reasons for his removal. And so with that, he said he had enough information, didn't need to move further, and so Scott drafted this basically official dismissal. Okay. So we just need, and I can read it. It just says, on June 17th, Adam Yates filed an appeal with the Bainbridge Island Civil Service Commission, appealing his removal from the eligibility list for lateral police officer in accordance with commission rules. A pre-hearing conference was conducted by the commission's hearing officer and a hearing date was set. On August 18th, 2014, Appellant Yates contacted Secretary Chief Examiner of the Commission, Amber Richards, by email and withdrew his appeal. A copy of the email is attached as Exhibit A to this order. Accordingly, Mr. Yates' appeal is dismissed, done this day of September. So, and you're certainly welcome to read it. The email is attached as an attachment A, and it's
okay, great. Well, okay, and we also have consideration of motion exam options.
Okay, so I know that we had talked a little bit at our last meeting about, looking into whether or not we were going to doing a promotional exam, and I heard back from the chief that if you want to promote from within is the kind of direction that the department wishes to take, and so I contacted John Walters of PSC to look into. I actually did a request through their listserv to see what options people generally use for promotions, and the thing that most came back was that people use the services that PSC provides for promotional exams. So I had circulated the information that John provided about the promotional process, and I also spoke with him about it as well. Basically, they offer a promotional assessment center, and it's custom for the department and the position, so it would be a pretty in-depth process where they would work with the department to figure out what position is, what sort of things we were looking for in candidates. It's very department and position specific. So basically, they would put a package together for us to, whether it be a lieutenant or a sergeant or whatever the position would be, they would kind of put that whole process together. Similarly, I think, to what we did with the oral boards, how they basically provided us with a package process. And we would then administer that, I think. There's different ways to do it. I think to do like a round robin sort of exercise where people are tested, you know, based on different strengths, different abilities, different skill sets. But that's basically the gist of it, from what I understand. And like I said, I have all the information here, but a lot of this, because it's basically very department specific, like I mentioned, a lot of the information that was in what they provided is just kind of generic. You know, this is kind of how we design it. This is the process flow. But basically, just to reiterate, they would meet with the agency, identify, you know, a point of contact, subject matter experts, so people within the department or whomever that they were looking to kind of glean information on. They would get a job description and set the expectations. They would gather all the expectations of the job being tested, do all the job task analysis, prioritize the dimensions, they build a scoring matrix. Anyway, it's pretty involved. And so they provide us with everything we need, and then we administer the exam.
Okay.
So that was ultimately what I found out. And like I said, I didn't just want to ask PST, so I did submit a request through the listserv to see if there are other agencies out there that are doing something different, but really the feedback that I got back was people use this process and it works really well. So,
PST seems to be the hometown group.
Yes. So, and I mean, there's also in one of the things he provided was the promotional testing and assessment center. They have a client list for all the, you know, the agencies that are currently using this, and it's pretty extensive. So,
okay. And I went through the rules, and I was trying to find some guidance on how the whole process goes, because it's been a long time since we did the mission, and I think probably, Bob, you're the only person at the table.
We didn't do any, not when I was aboard the prior commissions, we didn't do any promotion.
Okay, kind of new territory, I guess, for all of us. I went through the RCWs, the Muni Code, and the Civil Service Rules, but it looks like there's three decisions to be made. The first one under Rule A1 is a decision whether it's going to be an internal or external exam. And if you go later in the rules, 8-9, really states a pretty clear bias in favor of it being an internal exam. I think there really has to be a finding on our part that there aren't any good internal applicants before we go to an external process. So I think that first one, to give it justice to a quick go-around, but there definitely is in the rules that strong bias towards the internal exam. The second was going to be the form of the exam. And looking it over, I really like that Cadillac proposal, the assessment center. And it does seem to be the state of the art. Do we have any idea what the expense of that process is versus the traditional written in?
No, I don't. So John and I had a pretty extensive conversation about a number of different things, and I'll talk more about that when it's my update.
Sure.
But one of the things I think that it is probably a more expensive option, but worth.
Yeah, I think so. And we ought to get that at the round table. I think too, for the number of promotions we do, we want to get it is worth buying the Cadillac. It should be a good product. But I'm really interested to hear what Matt has to say on that point.
When I was at the NA last week conference, I talked to, because we were talking about promotions and I knew this was coming up, almost exclusively from my understanding is all the law enforcement agencies in DeKalb County started taking.
And what about the Cadillac Assessment Center versus traditional what now?
Cadillac being more accurate at 10 points.
Okay. Okay, I think
so. I think you're on the right track.
I think we may have the easy one here. Right? I think it's definitely worth the money. And then the third decision, and I didn't find any guidance here, and Amber, help me out if I got something wrong. The applicant's qualifications for those who apply. What are going to be the requirements for someone to apply to the functional exam?
I would like to make some recommendations. You're asking Amber, I mean, you're looking at me, I'm assuming.
Well, I'm looking to Amber to see if we have anything on paper that I'm not aware of, because when I make dumb mistakes occasionally, Amber's really good helping me out. And then I'm really interested for your recommendations, what you think they should.
The only information, to my knowledge, that we have defined in here is what defines a lateral candidate. I'm not aware, after just off the top of my head, that there's anything that indicates.
Just as a hypothetical, if a person who is getting ready to send to the academy wants to apply for this promotional exam, then I take that application.
You're again looking directly.
Yep, I'm looking right. Boom.
Okay. Well, I think there should be definitely a seniority requirement. I don't think we take 1 year. You know, for example, a John Bingham, or because he has not actually been a lateral officer on a state proceeding. He would be an example of one that I don't think should be allowed to apply because he doesn't have enough experience. So there should be a certain number of years. Veteran officers should be the ones applied, so there should be a restriction on how many years they've been on the department. I think part of that is going to have to include their prior law enforcement experience. I don't think you can take a five-year veteran that spent 5 years or 10 years somewhere else. They've been here 2 years and say you don't have enough experience to be a sergeant. You've got 12 years total. On the other hand, someone who's an entry-level officer gets treated for 2 years, definitely I think should be allowed to apply for a sergeant position. There's got to be some bias. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah. We need to have a job announcement, and that has to state the qualifications. I also did something else, which is kind of like a question I've had in the back of my mind, and haven't really been willing to put on the table because it's more important for us. Are we going to promote a new lieutenant, or are we going to promote a new sergeant?
Okay, that was going to come in my update, but I'll answer that since it is pertinent to this conversation. I've offered an MOU to the Guild to eliminate the current lieutenant position and create three new sergeant positions. So I'm currently...
Okay, you know there was a history with that. It's been tried before.
I know. Okay. I know. And Thomas Edison tried to get the light bulb like several thousand times, and it finally worked. But yes, and so we're currently in negotiations with the Guild.
What is the difference?
Yes, why?
Well, because the responsibilities of a lieutenant currently that we have on the department are dissimilar, not similar to what we would have as a first line supervisor as a sergeant. And to be consistent within Kitsap County, there is no, not just Kitsap County, the state of Washington, I don't know anywhere that goes from patrolman to lieutenant anywhere in the state of Washington.
Too big a jump.
So not only that, the other problem is departments have done this, and the reason they've done it is to bypass other rules. Some of those rules, and I will give an example, is the FBI National Academy minimum rank requirement is lieutenant. So if you have that title, regardless if that is the next first level of supervision on the department, they would accept that person. And so it's almost, to me, a little deceitful to have someone at that rank and that really not be. And we're not consistent throughout the day. And the other thing, when you have incidents with other agencies and you're combining, and I will tell you, all the councils on our side, we work together. There's some confusion when, lieutenant, sergeant, and if that's your first line supervisor, that's what you're doing. So,
what would be the difference, though? I still haven't got it yet. Besides the title, what's the difference
responsibilities.
In their responsibilities?
Because we now have a deputy chief, and so responsibilities that were relegated to lieutenants would then not be, would fall on the deputy chief, and then you would just, I'll just use Polesville, Fort Orchard, and Bremerton the same way. You have your officers, then you have the sergeants, and then you have a deputy chief. Bremerton might be different, but definitely Fort Orchard and Polesville, who are very similar in size, have the same thing. So we haven't had a deputy chief here for 2 years. I don't know. 2 years.
The title's been longer than that. We had a deputy chief, then we had the position commander.
Which were functionally the same, but we never changed general orders. We never changed organization. So it was always titled deputy chief, retitled.
There's also a big organizational flexibility issue. People go, does a Bainbridge lieutenant really equate with a Bremerton lieutenant in terms of responsibilities and scope of work? and a talking point that I've used quite a bit, is normally when you talk about command staff of the department, talking management level or above, benefit above, on paper right now, we have the same command staff, the titled lieutenants and above, identical to Lakewood PD, five times the size of the agency. Now they have sergeants, they have first line supervisors. We don't call a first line supervisor.
So it's muddied the waters. You've got a lieutenant who's doing...
line with everybody else.
Yeah, exactly. It puts you back in line with the rest of the state. And there's responsibilities that current lieutenants have that'll fall to the deputy chief and would put them in a position of being first-line supervisors. So...
Chief, is there a big compensation difference between lieutenant and sergeant?
We would make it the same pay.
Oh, well, then it's
so we're not going to change.
Title issue.
That's right. So,
all right.
The
well,
other
then
thing,
that makes all.
Then that's a great question. With the guild, we've said pay will stay the same because, well, that's the other thing. Our lieutenants are paid at the sergeant level.
Right.
So we've agreed that there'll be no pay. You will not lose a dime, lieutenant. You will get your same pay. Just be called.
Me, that's what I would.
Well, exactly. That affects no, the pay, that affects
responsibility.
Yeah, organizationally, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, okay.
It's just legal. No problem. That's what we killed it last time.
Well, it's a new day. And like I said, right now we're in negotiations. We'll see how it goes. So I think what we, this is my, you know, my take on it. You're the commission. I would prepare as though we're going to have sergeants, which are first line supervisors, and we've already worked on a job description.
There's another thing you may want to keep on the table just in case your current intended plan doesn't quite come to fruition, is you can also create a position of sergeant lieutenant. And those people that were appointed to the position before, you know, magic cutoff day, which would be today, you simply continue to call lieutenants. Nobody gets demoted, no one's ego gets bent. And the guy who gets promoted to that position after today, we call a sergeant, we put stripes on his sleeve. And over time, the problem solves itself. And keep the compensation the same and title and position the same, they're going to be functionally equal. It still works, and maybe we'll do an end run around the battle.
Have you experienced any resistance to this idea?
For the sake of negotiations, I'm not going to comment. Well, Rackett, we're in the middle of negotiating, so I think it would be unwise for me to begin to comment on where we're at in that negotiation process.
The MOU process is also outside the commission.
It is. So I would respectfully decline to answer your question because I don't right now the negotiations are
where they're going. I'd hang on to that combined title just as a fallback. It gets you all the same goals. You don't have to take something away from somebody.
The intent then, if this plan works out, is to change the title of two existing lieutenants to sergeant and hire one new sergeant. Is that your intent? From our scope, that's what we're looking for, is how many bodies do we need to interview for how many open positions? Is that what we're looking for?
The MOU states that we would do away with the rank of lieutenant, that we would, I'm trying to remember if I was told how deep to go into this because we're in the middle of negotiations. Can I respectfully decline to answer that until next time? We may need more promotions.
Yeah,
I don't know how deep to get into the details of, because those, yeah.
You know, I think it may be best to keep that off the table.
Yeah, can I wait on that, Rob? I mean, I'd love to tell you. I mean, I would love to tell you, but right now, let's prepare.
Right now, we've got really three decisions, I think, that we need to reach at this table. I think we've had some pretty good dialogue. Let's see if we can take it one by one. The first is whether we do an internal or external examination. And I think, given the bias that's stated in the rules, are we all comfortable saying that this will be an internal examination to be limited to current employees?
Assuming there's enough candidates for the roles. Yeah.
I think it's imperative that we do that because if you're an officer with Vantage Police and you don't have any hope of going up the ranks, why are you going to apply or why are you going to stay with the department?
It's important for the internals. I think the reason the decision was there is if you did find yourself in a position where there were no qualified applicants to get a bigger app, I certainly hope that's not the case. and I think we're best served following the bias in the code and making an internal examination.
Chief, you feel very comfortable there's enough people within the department to fill these roles?
Yes. I'm very confident that we have very capable individuals and great sergeants.
Okay.
And I think it would, to your point, years and years, that if we were to go outside, you'd kill the morale department.
Okay. So
are we
comfortable making our first decision to go in favor of internal examination?
Yeah.
Okay. That was the easy one, I think. Okay. The second then is the form of the examination. And I think I very much prefer the assessment center. Does anyone have a different view or anything we should discuss before we make the decision for assessment center or position test? Or a third
I really read this, and I particularly like how they custom build it to fit the needs of people. I think that's very important, something that would work in one community. I mean, this is a unique community with everybody being an expert in everything. I mean all the citizens. And so I think that I think it's really important that we have an examination that does fit the needs of our community and industry.
Yeah, and PST seems to be pretty responsible. They seem to have mastered the business of the state.
I think that Kathy, can I address two things? To address your point, whether we're promoting one or more, I think when you put this process together at this point, it's not going to affect what you're doing, your work now. So I think waiting on that answer isn't going to slow down preparing the promotion process, because if you get to that final product and now we've got, you know, more than one promotion to make, you're going to have everything in place to do that. But I will get you an answer as soon as I can. So I wanted to address that, but that's not going to slow down this process to frame a promotional process. And to your point, I do think it should be custom made. Again, as I talked last week with several chief executives of the departments, they said you want to make sure you do that, because they need to understand what the expectations here are. And there are different, I will tell you, there are different expectations here. I found the level of service that we give to the community much higher than I have seen in other law enforcement agencies. Now, we have more time to do that here because you're not, you know, getting 30 radio calls in a 6-hour period. But on the other hand, if an officer isn't accustomed to that or supervisor isn't accustomed to that level of service, we'd be falling down the job. So I agree with you. I think in those in-basket exercises, and having been, as several of us here have been through these promotion processes, written and oral just did not cut it as far as mine. And I've talked about that for entry-level officers, and we're going to talk about that for promotions. We've all seen those individuals that can take a great test and do great in an oral interview to get them on the street. Like that should never have been super. So, to your point, yes, and it should be custom to what we expect of the supervisor here. So that those expectations are started early on, that individual, that candidate, knows what's going to be expected down the road, because it's not going to change. You don't want to tell them one thing in a testing process, then you get them out of the street, and it's the old thing about, forget everything you learned in the academy, we're going to teach you how we do it out here. That's the last thing you want for a supervisor. You want to give them that consistent message of what we expect. So to your point, that's extremely imperative.
Okay.
Just a couple follow-up questions. As far as the customizing that assessment center and inputs from our department, advanced application of that, are all of those inputs and that customization going to be held at the command staff level? Because my worry is that one of the existing supervisors is asked, you know, describe your job. What things make you a supervisor now? And the very people that might be interviewing for that are also inputting information. Creation of that assessment.
I think it should come from everyone, because I don't care who you are or where you've worked. If you've worked in any field very long, how many of us have taken a leadership class? And one of the first, I love the question, how many in here know a bad thing? Everybody raise your hand. So we know what we don't want in a leader. And then the next question is, what's a good leader? And everybody can raise your hand and go, this was the best boss that flourished under this person. So I think it's from the newest officer, because our newest officers have worked other places for many, many years. So I think input from the bottom all the way to the top is important. So whether it's through survey, whether it was, you know, what traits do you rate forth, or however we go about doing that, we can have a list of traits and have them write it. So, Rob, I think we ought to get input from, and why not the civilian staff? They watch what those supervisors do every day. They're also a great asset to say, this is what we would expect of good supervisors. So I, and again, community members, like we did when we held the forum for traits of a good officer. I guarantee you people would have input on what traits of a good supervisor on paper does. Something to think about too.
Trenton?
Yeah, I'm fine.
That's
good.
Okay, so it sounds like everyone, I'm hearing kind of unanimous thought for assessment center. Any deviation from that before we lock it in? Okay, assessment center from the assembled by public testing. We'd like to review their proposal, I think, before we actually sign off on it. And forgive me, I didn't bring this up, but roundtable it. I did very much like the at least some aspect of public involvement. I like it in the form of interview, but I kind of like to hear what public testing's recommendations are for bringing some public component. Okay.
One other follow-up. Because a sergeant position has not been created previously, and we don't have an HR job description, I know you guys are working on it, but I know that's something Kate and HR will have to sign off, and then B, it's in our rules, they call it a position profile or something as far as creating those minimum requirements, years of service, and that's something we will need to create after that job description is final. That will be one of our other to-dos.
Okay, so we want to lock in then public testing to devise assessment center for some element of public input, and then we can visit that in the next meeting or as soon as they have something to put on the table. Okay, and the third one are, what are going to be the requirements of the people that we will take applications from? We heard one which I like was, if I heard you correctly, a combined experience requirement, so much time total, but also so much time that has been served on Bainbridge Island. I think that's probably a good way to go. Comments?
Yeah, I think it makes sense. You have the minimum amount of policing experience and the minimum amount of policing experience from Bainbridge Island is what you're saying. Those two things. And
yes,
what would you set those at, though?
Yeah, I think for the... because I think you have to give credit to an officer who's come as a lateral, spent many years somewhere else. So I... But that profile, I think we need... I don't know if we should lock that down today, because I think part of that profile needs to be, you do what you want, commission, but do they have FTO experience? Have they been a supervisor somewhere else? Have they been a detective? Have they gone to, you know, have they been working on being a supervisor? At point, I'm familiar with a profile that gives credit for educational. I think it would be nice if that, the more education, they should be given credit for that. So I don't know if we can do that here in the state of Washington, but I think creating that profile is important in longevity, years of experience, detective experience, FTO, supervisory experience, educational level, disciplinary history. I don't know if all those things, but there should be some kind of profile that gives that person.
We don't have to lock it down today. What we do want to do, just so we don't get stalled, I'd like us to leave the room today. We haven't made those decisions. We're just having established the framework. So we'll be able to access the information we need to make those decisions, and the responsibility for accessing that information lands on somebody. So when we come back, we'll have somebody to provide answers, and then we can make a decision at the next meeting. I don't think we're going to be hiring.
Can I ask a question about that? Is it actually our responsibility to make those decisions, or is it our responsibility to approve the job?
Well, if I read the rules right, it's our responsibility to prepare the job description, which involves setting the requirements for the position. And that's what I'm going to look to Amber, because I didn't see a tremendously detailed guidance in the civil service position. That's what I read between the lines.
But just so you know, we'll work on the job description, and it would not include any of that besides this detail. The job description would be what the duties of that sergeant. be and what that
yeah, is. Wouldn't
it, it wouldn't include, like, well, this guy has to have FDO experience.
Actually, what I'm...
Chief, why wouldn't it do that? I don't understand that. I mean, I write job descriptions. I've written hundreds of them at the time. So why wouldn't you have, like, a minimum kind of qualification?
Those,
and actually, the word I should have been using...
Go ahead.
Yeah, qualifications, yeah. Yes. But when I'm talking about a profile, is you give credit to someone who's spent his, you know, first
right.
7 years on the department
sure.
doing things that would make a better sergeant.
Right, okay.
So you can't put that job description like...
No, I
this person hasn't tried to be an FTO.
Yeah, and excuse me, I may have spoken imprecisely. It's not a good thing to do like this. The word I should have used, okay, was actually the examination announcement, which will lay out the requirements. So someone should read the examination announcement and go, great, I can turn in the application, or... I don't have what they need. I can't do this, so I can't turn in the application.
So you want it to be the minimum of what you need in the examination announcement to qualify to apply
exactly.
for the position,
we need to identify those
okay.
who are going to take the application.
Yes, because they don't need to know what points they're going to get for a bachelor's degree. What they do need to know is, oh, I do have 5 total experience.
Yeah.
I can qualify. I would apply.
Yeah, and what, like on I write them, it would be something like, you know, minimum of so many years, preferences given for the following experience, add on if you have it, but it doesn't mean you can't apply for the job if you don't.
Yeah, we do the threshold, and I'm not sure if we want the guy that's in the academy. But
right, exactly. You just have to have a threshold. Okay. Thank you for clarifying that.
So I don't...
and
forgive me, I just speak from time to time. And usually when I set people throw something at me, they go, hey, you can't do that. And get it back on track.
Okay.
We don't have to make that decision. I think in this meeting, kind of want to have the framework to make sure we put the right things down there so that we get...
But the trans question, is that our job to do this, or is it to... what are...
Well, the way I'm reading it, it is. But Amber, you're the secretary examiner. I notice a dearth of guidance in our three governing documents. But it does, and I'm looking at the civil service rules.
Do you have a
7-1?
What qualifications, minimum qualifications for the promotion you want?
I don't have, not locked down like he was saying, 12-month Bainbridge Island. 24 months outside the department, so a total of 36. I haven't locked all those numbers down.
I'm looking at 7.1.1 to make them say.
But close to that, that's what we were talking about. I could do that pretty quickly and give it as a recommendation, however.
One year on the Forest Fund to really pick up the flavor?
But it depends. Here's the thought process. You know, that's why I say it's going to take some more thought than just jumping, throwing out numbers. Because say you have an officer who has, you know, 7 years of experience somewhere else, and he's a supervisor for 3 years, and now he's been here 2 years, and he's a rock star, he's a one. I don't think you'd want to exclude him from that application process because he was, you know, 3 months shy of an arbitrary.
Yeah, we're going
to do it.
I want to make sure that we open it up to the larger.
It's a gatekeeper function. You set the bar too low, then the assessment center could go, you know what? You got a lot of potential, but you're not there yet. And then that the promotion process.
But I get Kathy's concern too. Someone being here, you know, 12-month period is not enough. I got to think about that. I can't answer that right now. I mean, again,
that worries me.
Yes, I agree with you. But if you got a guy who's been an officer for 7 years somewhere else and was a rock star there and he's come here and been a rock star here for a year, I hate to shut it down and say, no, you don't qualify. Like, to Rich's point, let that process kind
of... You also have the flip side. You have somebody who may have 20 years of experience. What it really is 1 year of experience repeated 20 times.
Good point.
So you
need to make sure you got a robust enough process that will give that person 1 year credit, not 20 years.
Yeah.
I think another thing, and I don't know if we could write that in, but in looking for people to apply, you want to see what innovative programs on their own have they brought to the department. And I can think of one officer who I won't say his name, and I have no idea if he would even apply, but there are several programs, as replaced by your time that he has brought to the department that the department would have if it wasn't such an individual, and he did that as well. And so I think that's a real partner.
And having said that, that's why I think it's important that there's input on the assessment center, take into account that type of work history, however we do that, and then also that, you know, out of those top candidates, then you look at what those things can
Since we're limiting it to internal candidates, we have to be realistic. You have to look at the experience pool that you have, and you have to match it to that. Otherwise, it's silly.
Yes.
If you say it's got to be this threshold, and you only got two officers, well, then you're... So you have to, the chief has to take into consideration.
That's why
we have to take into consideration.
To make that decision.
What is the pool
today,
of experience? Yes. How many years have they been
on
average?
I'm in favor of setting the bar low and
just
letting the assessment center rank everybody. But I think that there has to be a bar because at some point, you know, again, you got to reinforce the significance of the position. And if we let the academy cadet apply the position, then it's kind of denigrating the position.
I also agree very much with what Kathy said. If you have an officer who's shown initiative, brought programs, done some things, they've really shown that they've tried to take some leadership. And I don't know how you define that. I think that's excellent.
Well, no, I agree.
That's absolutely the kind of person.
Yeah, that's the guy I want. But it should be the assessment center that points the arrow to that person and not the minimum bar that points the arrow to that person. Yeah, that is a person.
This has to be a thoughtful process. It's not so, you know, we can't say, oh, you know, you got 24 months on Bainbridge, 5 years on so I just think we need to think through that.
And you were looking, I'm sorry.
And our department is small enough that you can actually tailor these requirements to the force you have. So I'm sure you have an idea of who is going to apply and who we want in each of these positions. And I'm sure you will be able to make a bar that is the perfect level to.
That's a great point. I mean, maybe we're pointing the elephant out in the room, but I think that's important to note that because we're doing internally, because we're such a small department, you're going to know very quickly
who you're limiting it to.
So we have to be careful to make sure that we're being
I was thinking that too. It's really, because it's such a small department, it's really important that the qualifications and examinations are as unbiased as they possibly can be, because that for many different reasons.
Well, morale, number one, you don't want to create a situation where people perceive their something.
Yeah. We said that arbitrarily because that excluded Jeff Horn, so we're good.
Yeah,
we're
right
where we need to be. That's the elephant in the room. We've got to make sure that this, to your point, it's got to be unbiased and allow everyone that, and I think how we can do that, part of that process would be, and so that we're consistent, I think this gives credibility to the process is what are the other departments our size doing statewide? Because when you base it off that, you remove that personal bias that we're doing it for here. However everybody else does.
That leads us to the assessment stuff. But you know, that thing also works on the bottom on the top. You know, we're talking about excluding the people at the bottom. So once we get the list, we're still subject to the rule of three. So you'll get presented three names. And
good point.
A score difference.
Yep.
He'll have access to scores, right? So he'll know 1, 2, and 3.
Yep.
So that's also going to put an onus. Well, you know, if the number one guy from the assessment center, and we wind up appointing number 3 or number 2, that's going to create the same kind of appearance.
Well, and then let's take this one step further than the trust point. So we set these other things that give credit for certain things. Small enough department, we all know who's got what. So that's another thing that, and I don't want to create any morale issues by saying, oh, the chief or the commission devised these profile points to match Officer Smith.
Yep.
And look who got promoted. Isn't that amazing how that happened? And we've seen that even in larger departments, that they'll do certain things that, because the new chief is now ex-military, now you get huge points in the military. We're like, I wonder where that came from.
And that's where I like PSD, you see. Sorry. You were looking while we were talking. What was your take on 7-1-1?
Well, so I actually think you have to go back a little earlier. I think part of it is the classification part, I think, is where it really gets into what you're talking about, not necessarily the where you're talking about the applications.
Okay.
And this is something that I have to just admit right up front, is I need to talk to someone or to get a little bit more clarification, because I'm not exactly sure how this applies, but basically it says that a class specification shall be prepared and maintained for each class in the civil service, and specifications shall describe the class generally and distinguish it from other classes, give examples of duties of the class, and contain, when applicable, a statement of those qualifications for applicants and positions in the class. There's only a few exemptions, which are the chief, it says in here commander, but that would be the deputy chief, and then public safety administrative coordinator. So to me, what that means is that maybe we're not making the job description, but we are making, the commission has the responsibility to make the classification
okay,
plan, which is similar. And then there's also, it talks about a classification study, where the commission will make or cause to be made a position classification studies of individual positions or groups. So you could, you know,
okay.
There's more. I think if you read Rule 6, it explains more.
Background on that, and that's what we had done, I believe, 2 years ago for the officer candidates, because the officer position profile or classification study hadn't been updated in a decade or something. So we did exactly what you're talking about. We sent around surveys to everybody in the department. Everybody essentially identified their what they did on a day-to-day basis, and then what skill sets you needed to have to be able to fill that position. And then HR, Kate, essentially creates, and with the chief's and leadership's position, creates that job description of what that position is. And then we as a commission created that classification position profile that said, okay, anybody that applies for an officer must have these minimum qualifications. We've never had done one at the lieutenant level. This was hired years ago, so we never got to that step of doing the next rung up the ladder for creation of those positions. So we'll need to do one for sergeant and tenants, or and because we were thinking about doing one for detective, but that's really under the officer rank even too now.
And there's one more rule that actually I think clarifies a little bit more completely. It says each position in the classified service shall be classified at the direction of the commission and allocated to its appropriate class in accordance with the character, difficulty, and responsibility of its designated duties. Positions shall be allocated to a given class when same descriptive title may be used to designate a position in the class. The same level of education, experience, knowledge, ability, and other qualifications may be required of incumbents. Similar tests may be used to select incumbents. Anyway, so Rule 6 talks more to that.
Rob kind of stole my thunder. I want to make sure you don't have none of the wrong. We'll do that quick. So,
no, I love this cup.
Okay, good.
Not that you're but the cup is very important. I just want you to understand your level.
That was great.
I've got I know the answer, but just the diagnostic question kind of brought it. Do we have such a document, the position of police sergeant?
Not to my knowledge, I don't think
so. I think what we probably need to do, we slayed two out of three dragons pretty fast, but I think the third one to do right, we're not going to be able to make. We probably do need to retire and let you do all the staff work up on the classification study for police sergeant. And realizing that the MOU changes to make that happen are outside the purview of the commission. Probably need to time that, and I also want to be careful we don't put anything on the public record in this meeting that would frustrate that process. We probably need to shape the timing of that classification study around the information issues. That probably, I don't want to be optimistic will happen by our next meeting, but we probably need to set an open date to visit that document before we move any farther. But we have slayed the dragon about PST, so at least we can start PST, I think, doing the staff work to come up with a supervisory position if we just stay away from the nomenclature of what we're going to call that position. I mean, we call it first-line supervisor. I think that's safe. I probably want to stay away from sergeant or nomenclature just because of the ongoing process. And I think that's probably all going to be the big time consumer. So then we're probably well positioned to sit down once the negotiation process matures, PSD comes up with the process, obviously, then we can look at the, make sure I don't make my mistake again, the examination announcement is properly prepared, and I think we've got to get everything to come together in 2-3 months from now.
I have one thing.
Sure.
I would like to know what the cost is of PST. I think it's our responsibility as commission members to know exactly.
I am concerned about the cost.
Yes, but I think we should at least know.
This is one of those things, given our history, you know.
I don't want to be like we just made a decision without any thought about what it's going to cost.
And the checkbook is a city manager item.
Right.
But I think this is one that, unless the cost is really over the top, it's probably more expensive.
No, I'm not disagreeing with this. I'm just saying we should at least know what it is if we are agreeing to it, in my
opinion. Sure, we can ask. And it's a good question.
Yes.
I don't know if it's going to mention it's positive. It's a good question. Let's ask PST.
Well, I'm having a meeting with John, who is the owner of PST. He will be at the commission, the civil service conference.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I are going to meet to discuss a number of different things. And so that is one of the, he was going to put together a package for us with pricing, but we're not quite at that point yet. So
sure.
The price is coming. It is a question I've asked, but I just don't, at this point, it's because it's custom, because there's a lot of different elements. I think he needs to really get an understanding of what exactly we need.
Understood.
And there were some other things involved with that, and then we'll get a price. So. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I don't want you to think that I would just like...
No, I know you wouldn't. Okay. No, I just think that's our responsibility.
One other follow-up for something to include in that checkup. Can you check with CJTC? I know on sometimes the licensing requirements, there's a minimum number of training hours or minimum training they have to complete before they're eligible to be licensed as a first-line supervisor, so there may be some statutory licensing requirements. I know in Texas you had to have 800 hours accumulated through TCOS before you could even apply to be a sergeant. That was on a state level. Before you can even do it in your department. So that may be another bar that we have to check to make sure we're meeting.
Yep. We'll absolutely do that.
Okay. Unfinished business. Consider setting oral interview schedule?
Yes, we just recirculated this one from the last time. So I've had a number of conversations, or I guess one really, with the chief about the need to set another oral board schedule. So. Currently, I'll just give a quick status update. Currently, there still is only one vacancy that I have been made aware of. So we still only have, the rule of three. There's, I believe, one lateral candidate left, and there are still five actually entry level candidates, and they have the department has three that they're looking at. I did receive a request to remove one individual from the entry-level list, but I am waiting for further information before I can do that, and I'll talk a little bit more to that.
And we're processing that one under the new rule?
Right. So when I received that, I contacted the administrative coordinator over at the police department because according to the process that we just implemented, I will make the threshold decision of whether or not that person should be taken off the list. And as long as it meets the requirements or basically meets the disqualifiers, then I contact them, I officially notify them and let them know in writing why they were, why they are being disqualified, and then if they want to appeal that decision, I provide in the letter instructions for them to appeal so that they can come to the commission with an unbiased, basically to have an appeal without the commission having already heard the evidence. So that, and I did, so I just, so you guys know, when I received the memo to disqualify this candidate, I did contact Scott because I feel like I always call Scott, but because this is a new process, I wanted to make sure that I understood what the expectation was of me. And Scott, I basically ran through, this is what I am understanding I'm supposed to do. Scott said, absolutely, we discussed there's a number of things that are on this memo that really are not disqualifiers. However, there is one.
Just to keep us pristine, we don't want to set what.
Right, and I'm not going to bring that up. But Scott's advice to me was make sure that basically he said stick with the automatic disqualifiers. As long as there's an automatic disqualifier, then I can go ahead and send the letter. He also said that I need to see the evidence of that. So that's the thing that I'm waiting on, is that I contacted the police department. I said, I need to see proof that this qualifier actually exists. And until I receive that, I haven't made any further action. So currently the person is still on the list. No notification has been made. I'm awaiting the evidence of that. And once those things come through, then I will notify them, so long as it, you know, it is actually, you know, there. And then I will let the commission know, you know, also that a person has been removed. But currently, it was, at this point, it's nothing more than a request. So at that, with that being said, there is still only one vacancy, and the lists that we have, that, you know, there are eligibles on the entry level list, and there's one lateral. So that is the standing. Another thing to consider, to kind of keep in mind, I guess, is that I have actually received two more lateral applications. So at this point, we have seven lateral applicants, two of which, one was a candidate that had applied for the last oral board and was not able to attend due to a schedule conflict. He wasn't able to reschedule, so he asked to be kept on, you know, kept, he wanted his application to be held for future oral board. So we have one kind of that has rolled over, and then we have one candidate that has applied again, which we discussed at the last meeting. So those make up two of the five. There are five additional. Something else, I guess, to note about that is that a couple of the candidates have actually done testing through PST. They're out of state, and they came up to, you know, because there are other departments that require the written test, so they came up to do that and have applied with us, but we're also willing to, you know, come to do the testing. So I did want to just kind of make that point as well, to try to give a full, you know, all of the facts about where things stand. So that's kind of where we are right now, and based on that, I don't know how the commission feels about moving forward.
Is there any preference to a lateral versus a new candidate for this role?
No. The only preference was what we had, you know, discussed in the last meeting. So there is no preference. There is nothing in the rules that indicates that we have, you know, give preference to entry versus lateral.
So this will be filled by either.
Correct.
Yeah, the chief gets his list of three for laterals and for new hires, and then can make an assessment where the department's at. You have a different equation for a lateral, different pros and cons, and things for new entry. Chief gets to arbitrate to make the selection.
I was just wondering if we had enough candidates to schedule oral based on what you were saying.
That's we absolutely have enough entry level. We always have
enough entry level.
Right. The entry
lateral level, you may not.
Right, correct.
If I heard you right, we have six potential candidates surviving now, five new hires, and one lateral.
Correct.
I hope this is appropriate to ask. As far as lateral candidates are concerned, because this is a small part, are they coming, why do they want to come to base camp? What's the profile of a person applying the lateral position?
Well, we can take the example of Bingham and Ledbetter, the first two hires I made, since I did the first two options I hired as chief. Bingham lived here 31 out of 35 years
right.
Being alive, so there's a lateral that wanted to be, that was his reason, he lived here his whole life, there's a volunteer member. The second one was John Ledbetter, and I think I talked about at his swearing in what his reason was. His sister moved to Seattle to be home to sit. He's from Naples, Florida. He was a lateral, and he came here because he visited his sister and thought it was absolutely gorgeous. They came across the ferry, saw Bainbridge, and thought, oh my gosh, this is perfect. So him, you met him and his wife.
Either during the summer or during the winter.
We're not going to mention that in this public meeting, just in case there's laterals that are watching. but so when you ask, there's my first two hires, one from right here on the island, and the second being from Naples, Florida.
I guess where my concern is when it comes to a lateral is someone coming from a large department to such a small department, why are they choosing to do that? doing that. I don't mean that in a derogatory way, but...
Like from Indianapolis.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. Can I answer that question? I think if you've got anybody who's worked in a large agency, it's tough. I've got to be careful if I say this. This is an oasis. This is nice. This is,
I understand that.
So if you're a veteran, if you've worked in a large agency, they have issues that large agencies have.
I hear what you're saying.
And here is, we have our own issues, right? Every department, no matter where you go, your workplace has issues. Crime levels, we're the third safest city in the nation. You start getting older, you start having kids going to junior high and high school. Where do you want to go to school? Whether it's officers on guard, 20 officers assigned to the school, or where, you know, they've got free access to walk down the Safeway during the day in high school and feel pretty safe. So, I mean, you could get into a myriad number of reasons. I think maybe what you're getting at, Kathy, and I will address it, is, are we getting officers that are trying to put you somewhere else because they got problems? Betcha. I can tell you, many of the individuals that we disqualified, and I won't get into names or reasons, but yes, they were, in my opinion, leaving because there were other issues. That's not who we want. And I will tell you, and I think the commission will know this based on the number of disqualified applicants that I've had, we look very, very closely at applicants. And if I see something in there that I think would not be good for Bamber Down, I'd rather go short and officer and have some separation problems. That's where I fall down on those issues, because sometimes farms get so needy, they're like, well, we'll take them. Then yeah, you've bought problems that are far worse than paying someone overtime to work the shift. And I think I've been, I mean, you guys can, you've seen them. I've been very judicious in who we decide to hire, and that's why I would request that this commission start another oral interview process. There are going to be several more disqualification letters come to Amber, and we're not going to have anybody on the list. And I can tell you, we've been through all of them. I know for the lateral applicant, have you received anything on the last lateral? That will be forthcoming. And there will be other disqualification letters on the entry level. So my request would be to gear up for another oral interview board on both sides as those come along, because I've already seen all the ones that we have in their histories. And you know, I don't want to comment today, but I can tell you it's not looking good.
I've always been in mind your best people and your worst people are going to be laterals. A lot are trying to escape their present situation. You need to have a vetting process to find them. But like Chief said, the big agency, you know, after 20 years, you know, big agencies are really good at getting blood out of a turnip and get maximum work product out. You get burned out pretty fast. You can only handle life on that high-speed treadmill so long before you get back problems, heart problems, and you get older and you need to change. But the other issue is there's also kind of a cultural thing or just environmental thing, where with small agencies, you only get just so much experience, and to have a fully robust career, you realize you got to move. I started out with a 12-person department, 2 years, you know, been there, done that, and not a whole lot left to do. So a lot of people also tend to go through a progression of smaller departments, and that's made easier with state retirement systems. So that rather than trying to get a new experience by going to a new assignment with a big agency, they just go to another small agency. And to a certain extent, that turnover is healthy in terms of giving people a wide variety of experience. And then those folks are also really good to find coming from a small agency that want to be here because we have something to benefit them. Namely, you know, the work environment is kind of completely different, and the ability to do some community things is more available here than just about anywhere else.
And to have a community that actually loves you and supports you.
Yeah, and
it's refreshing.
And like you mentioned, you want officer. If you have somebody that really is of that mind, they're going to have a hard time, you know, carrying out that career goal in Tacoma or Seattle. So they're going to have a pretty easy time doing it here. So you want to be that person and get them here. But the problem is, for every one like that, there's probably three or four that are on the verge of losing their job attorneys, they're going to get glowing reviews from former agents because they want them to leave. We've got to have a vetting process to idea.
And the other thing to remember, if I just comment, we're losing our applicants, by the way, because some of them. So that's why, I would encourage you to move forward with getting the list done. Kitsap County just hired one of our entry-level candidates, a young female officer that was phenomenal. She was entry-level. And they took her because we didn't get a chance to get it. They just, before we could get to all the backgrounds we were working through, they got her. I told the sheriff of Kitsap County that I actually asked Detective Weiss to make a call to her and ask her if she'd, once she gets to the academy, would she come back? Because we're stealing from each other. And you know, we've lost many good officers from this department. I can name six or seven that I've met on other parts. I didn't realize they worked here.
Oh, yeah.
Very highly qualified and good. So it's important that we because there's such a lack of numbers, when we have openings, we need to get them interviewed. And I will tell you, I've been contacted by current people on the entry-level list, current people on the lateral list, just saying, hey, I just want you to know how interested they come and done ride-alongs with our department, which to me says good things. They really want to be here doing ride-alongs. They're not just throwing a name out trying to get hired by somebody. That helps. And so they're anxious to be here. So, again, my plea to this commission is let's get started on some more interviews on both sides.
Now, one.
Have we hired any entry-level candidates yet?
Yes. Well, not me.
Right. So, I mean, but it's been a while since that's occurred.
No.
Right?
Yeah. Gary Kuhn was an entry-level, and I don't... he might be there 2 years.
So it's been about 2 years.
It's been about... Okay. But that's not very long when you consider right now Belia for entry-level. So
right.
You know, they're getting March class. So if we hired someone, if I had hired that female from the sheriff's store, brother, if I had hired her today... She wouldn't start Belia until March. So what they're doing now in the state, we talked about this last week, a lot of departments are doing the MTO program prior to the academy, which is totally backwards. But you got, and then what they do is after the academy, they do a refresher MTO course. But that way, they're not waiting for that six-month academy and then waiting for another 4 months in MTO.
Actually, that's not that bad. That's my first agency did with me.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's what we're, and that's what we would do in order not to lose a good entry level candidate. But I couldn't steal her away from the ship.
Okay, well, how does this sound? I'm also kind of really desirous to look at the way we did the last round of orals and see if there's a way we could improve the process before we do it again, because I know it's kind of new for everybody. The lessons learned. How does this work for everybody? You can sit down and maybe try and have some dialogue with the interview panelists from the last go around, including the ones from your department. Try and just do a lessons learned kind of after action report and try and fine tune the process for next time and then schedule a next round.
Were we going to discuss also if we were still satisfied? Lateral is doing oral and not written. If I recall, that was on the table.
That was going to be revisited in December. At the last meeting, that was the request to have that on the December agenda. So it's still something that's on the table, but...
Yeah, and then we may want to go kind of right, because there's big arguments on both sides. Yeah. I like the idea of treating lateral applicants as tenured professionals, which you... to get more of them. You know, it's kind of like if you were screening for a law partner job, you know, would you really want to off up your own SAT scores?
We need more information.
But we probably ought to go around that one. Yeah, that one, I suspect we may not have unanimity. There's a lot of dialogue.
I've got a feeling we might not.
So, yeah, and if we don't, then having some good background for some time to dialogue.
And then one of the other discussion points we had last time was updating our rules. This may be a question for Scott on the ability for applicants to reapply after either disqualification or failing a portion of the test.
I thought I saw some email mid-month. I think probably one year was about the
Yeah.
And I have an official update. No, there's no change has been made to the rules, but I can do my talk about this now if you want, or I can wait till my section. But I did speak with Scott about the legality of putting a restriction, a 1-year restriction for testing, and also having a lifetime, a lifetime limit of the number of times that someone can apply. And Scott said there's no legal reason why either of those cannot be done. His caution was not to take an extreme measure based on one case. And his other recommendation was that I actually speak with John of PST, because John designed our oral interview, and that PST should be able to give us a recommendation of, what they think is reasonable for their testing process. And so I talked to John actually about a number of different things, but to this point he said it is incredibly common for people to have a year. He actually laughed when I said we had a 90-day, laughed about that. And he said it is very common for people to have a minimum of a year to retest. He said for the written exam that PST does, that our entry-level candidates take, that just that exam alone is 6 months, and they have, they change that. They don't change the process. They change the elements of that on a regular basis. So that on top of all that, they still have a 6-month waiting period for retesting. But he said it is very common for departments to have a minimum of a year. He said it's also very common for departments to have a lifetime limit of reapplication. He said some don't let people reapply at all. So there's nothing against doing that. And so I think if you kind of take, what Scott was getting at, or Scott's point, alongside what John was saying, that I think so long as we are making a reasonable decision for implementing something like that, there's really no justifiable reason why you couldn't implement change the rule to have either a longer waiting period and or a lifetime limit in number of times that someone can apply. So that was one element, or one kind of item that's related to this. So
just to follow up on that, if we decide today to change the rule from 90 days to 1 year, are existing applicants in pool grandfathered under the old pools, because that's what they've applied on? They applied under the 90-day limit. Change it today, any candidate that applies tomorrow would be a 1-year limit, but both candidates or existing and new candidates would still be subject to the 90-day limit.
Yes, that's my understanding, is that the rule would only apply going forward. I don't think we could...
It's not retroactive.
Yeah. Right. So that is, something to keep in mind. But it would be effective immediately and kind of, prevent the issue from occurring again. So that's one.
Another follow-up would be the idea about us needing more questions.
Yes. So that is another thing. So John and I spoke pretty in-depth about doing a pool, basically putting together a pool of questions so that we could, randomly choose from the different, because we have, there's eight key traits that have been defined in our questions, screen for people to meet those key traits. And so so this kind of gets into a whole other can of worms, but one of the things that he recommended was, this is where we need to really talk a little bit more, because I don't have enough information to really make to exactly relay to him what we're looking for. His recommendation was that if we're basing our tests off the key traits were not developed systematically. So we could either start from scratch if we want a defensible set of traits. There is a process that you actually would need to go through to get traits that were developed in a manner that you could actually defend. So we have the option of doing that and kind of starting all over, or he said another option would be that we could just stick with the key traits that we have and build our question banks where we already are. But we lose some of the ability to be defensible, because the way that the traits were developed wasn't there wasn't much process around that.
If he goes through the development phase, and I can see where he's going with that, and down other places, does he have a bank question already developed for other agencies that could tweak to meet our kind of uniqueness without having to reinvent the whole field?
We could do that. I think the way that it was communicated to me when I asked, like, if there was a question bank, so they do not have a pool of questions. If we want a pool of questions, we can use the California Post, which is what we used last time. Those are questions that have been used over and over. They are, you know, vetted questions. So we have the ability to go through and, you know, look at all those different questions, and they screen for different traits as well. They're just not our traits. And that's what we did really for the lateral. He said if we want a pool of questions, that's something that they need to develop. They would develop specifically for us in a systematic way based on our traits in order to be basically as defensible as possible. And so we could easily go to the Post and pull, you know, 50 questions from each of the different categories that they have, and we can sit down. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I participated in the process, as you know, and I thought the questions were extremely well done. And for the entry-level candidates, not the lab. And I've done a lot of this many, many, many years, and I thought it was really well done, and they were very good questions. And I don't think it would be difficult to tweak those questions. I don't think we need to make this too complicated. I don't think we need to overthink this, is my concern, because then it just becomes a little tough. The basic criteria were there, particularly at least for entry-level questions. Entry-level applicants, sorry. I don't know about the lateral, but the entry-level, I thought it was pretty good. And then a lot of the other things are going to come out in the process later on when they're vetted, obviously, by the chief. And, you know, you're doing a lot more things. So I don't know. That's my view. But I only had that one.
And I'm kind of inclined to agree. I like that we tailored the questions to kind of fit our community. I like the idea of the one-year rule and the re-up. We don't need a super robust, list of questions. We do need a pool.
Yeah.
So I think what we may do is, and it may be good to hear from Scott, if he really gives any significant assessment to our defensibility issue. I don't know if I see that as being more than a red herring. And if it isn't, and if Scott can't point to anything, it may be good if we just sit down and brainstorm some morning, get a big pot of coffee, sit down and say, okay, here's where we're going with that question. Let's come up with five more that get us to the same place.
Yeah.
And that would give us a pool of five different questions for each trait. And then when you look at the mix and match for every applicant, we could probably run an applicant through five different exams before we hit any redundancy. And we're 5 years downrange, even if he does come back to us.
Yeah,
I think that would work.
I agree completely. Yeah.
And the questions, I would say, the questions that you experienced in the entry-level exam were developed by PSC. That was their process. The lateral, we used the process, but the commission chose the questions. And that's what, all those questions came from the California Post. Mm-hmm. So I think, at least from kind of where I see the whole thing, is we have a good process, and I feel like from everything that I've heard from John and Scott both, that for the most part our process is defensible. I mean, there are always, you know, different levels that we could take it to, but for what we need, this commission has done things really well when it, you know, related to that regarding the testing process, and has always been concerned with making it defensible. And so I think we have ended up with a really sound process when it comes to the actual examination. So, you know, we could easily continue to use that skeleton and just tweak the questions. And for me to pull, you know, I have thousands of questions that I can pull, you know, instantly from there. So there, you know, it's really up to you and how the commission wants to move forward.
So I kind of have a proposal on that realm. So, one, instituting a new rule to change 90 days to 1 year. Two, having a special meeting in the next 2 weeks or something as schedules will allow, with the only agenda topic item is the creation of additional questions out of that test bank. So then we can go, you know, October 1, we have a test bank of 21 questions or 30-some questions. However, we create an additional duplicate of that, and that's all we work on in executive session of creation of the test. Based on what you're able to pull together, if you want to work on a subcommittee based on your HR background and things like that of those additional assessment questions, then as we as a commission come up with that test bank, we have passed that on to John to bless, or however in his term to agree or not agree or tweak in some way if there's additional work to be done to make it work. And that's kind of a short-term way of addressing all that, and then perhaps we can go into October or early November with the next round of interviews.
The other thing that's important, though, isn't just the questions, it's who's asking those questions and who's making the evaluation. That's a very route that I was with, I thought was excellent. It was good to have someone from outside. You know, we had Kitsap Sheriff, we had obviously from the department. You have to have three or four people who are, you know, addressing the answers to those questions, because they themselves are not going to, you know what I'm saying. The evaluations, I thought, what was amazing is when we went through it. It was amazing how frequently the evaluations were the same.
One thing we tried to build in was a 360-degree look.
Right.
And I know that raised some issues with the Guild.
What's that?
We tried to build the interview panelists, so we had a 360-degree look.
That's good.
Law enforcement, community, men, so we got a full view around an applicant.
I wasn't aware of any issues.
And the idea, Eric raised one question. He raised a third point. Well, in the case of a lateral, you had some questions that were designed to test job knowledge, and you had a civilian who had no law enforcement background response. And on the surface, you can see the concern, but when you get down in the depth, well, no, the way the panel was designed, there's also dialogue panelists, so that the aspect of the question that the civilian was looking at is not did the person get concept of law 1, 2, and 3 correct to the response. We're looking for the law enforcement panelists to get that. But we do want the civilian member to look at the thought process, how did you evaluate 1, 2, and 3? Because that thought process evaluation is very critical from a non-law enforcement perspective. And it all kind of gets blended when the answer is evaluated. And Eric seemed satisfied with that. They did raise a concern that it seemed inappropriate to have both assessments be made that way.
I wasn't aware of that.
It was really interesting how much they were similar, even people with very different backgrounds, how everyone, you know, people from law enforcement, people with no law enforcement, how they still came out the same with each candidate with very little divergence. Didn't you think that was true?
Absolutely, yeah. The lateral panel was a little bit different, but there were a couple of issues with that. But on the whole, I still think that the process worked exactly the way that it was supposed to. And I think it was important to have, you know, from kind of facilitating the whole thing, I thought the dialogue between both, you know, law enforcement and civilian was good and important. And I think we really did end up with a great...
Did the Guild have a problem with civilians being on the panel, or was it just Eric?
No, it was a concern that the president raised, and he raised it informally. You know, there was some talk, I'm kind of concerned this happened this way, what do you think? And I gave him my thoughts, and he seemed satisfied with that. So it wasn't a formal concern, it was just something on the periphery. But it was a good point, as one deserved a response, and I think we got closure to, you know, in the hallway conversation.
To answer your question, I don't think we actually know if it was just his concern or the Guild's. I don't recall whether he presented it as his own or the concern of the Guild. I'm not sure.
I don't know if we should include the guys from Kitsap again because they pick up on our good candidates. I'm not kidding.
I'm not either.
He was there.
On the entry.
Yes, he was, and he was great. But I thought, okay, and then we talked about
that,
it. Just give him a bad time, but he was great.
Also works in reverse, and hopefully these two guys are burrowing over in Kitsap County and Bremerton as well.
That's right. That I would hope that would be the case.
So eventually,
exactly.
If Peter Robs fall long enough, it all comes out.
Yeah.
I was very upfront with Sheriff that we called that candidate to show up.
He's great, but
They're awesome. No, it is. It's friendly, but quite honestly, what's pulling at the same hand pool, kind of.
Well, does this work for everybody?
I think Rob made a good point.
Amber, can you poll everybody that was involved in the go-around and just kind of collect after-action comments? And let's do a good data call from everybody that participated. And then let's do that executive session meeting just on that subject. And see if we can come up with a better line of questions. That's when we're, everybody chime in if I got this wrong. I think we may be overkill if we try and go back and have PST design the formal text. I think we're probably better doing that in-house.
I agree.
And if we can, they'll come up with maybe there is a better framework based on what we learned, and if we can come up with a better question pool, and then we can go forward and schedule another round of interviews. But we want to try and perfect the process.
His timetable sounds good. Not that I'm a voting member, but I give my endorsement to his proposal.
Well, I'm here for 1 year.
Yeah. I think that's important.
One other thing to do in parallel to kind of address the panel selection process is I think we've done it a little reactive of asking the general public to apply to be a volunteer on our panel. And I think we should be maybe considering being a little bit more proactive in selecting that panel ourselves. If you know some
that
HR
was, that was kind of my
HR
point about who's on the panel
on the
really
island,
matters. Yes.
Going to the school district, getting a principal or a teacher to come and sit on the panel to represent educational ideas, and then maybe a downtown association business leader or a chamber of commerce member, that we're more self-selecting of representatives of that panel for our community instead of Joe Schmo, please come sit on our panel if you want to.
We also have the list of the graduates of the Citizens Police Academy that are obviously interested.
So I think we can do that in parallel along with these other things.
That's
so once
great.
We check all those boxes, we're ready to go with a robust panel for those.
Excellent.
Okay, well, let's, Amber, can you put together the wording? Actually, before I say that, is there any opposition to or discussion needed on the one-year reapplication period? That point was pretty well made. Can you prepare a rule change for our next meeting to implement a one-year retest period? And we can vote to adopt that rule change and vet it by Scott.
Yeah, that one would be really simple, honestly. I think it's just, the rule is so simple, it's just crossing out 90 days and putting 1 year. There's not really a need for like a significant, we're not really changing the language. So I can put it together, but there's just not much to do with that.
Is there any homework to be done, or is that something we can accomplish right now?
You guys could change the rule immediately if you really wanted to. It's like I said, with just the change of that, you're not changing really language, you're just changing the time frame.
Is there a motion?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Unanimous. And I was also with the understanding that it's only forward applied, not retroactive for those current.
Yeah. And I can, if you are interested, if the commission is interested in doing a limit, that is language because we don't currently have that in the rules. I could draft language and have Scott look at it if there's interest
in
that.
Let's go on the table. I got some thoughts, but I'll go last.
I don't necessarily see a specific need for a lifetime limit. I can envision a candidate that may apply, doesn't make it, but then goes to school or goes to the military for a few years and then comes back. Why should that candidate be eliminated? Because when he was 22, he didn't have all the requirements he needed. Or he became a reserve officer somewhere and came to reapply. So I would like to give that candidate some additional due, not just that initial one-shot strike.
I agree.
Yeah,
I think I agree, too. We have the 1 year. I think that's important.
Yeah, I agree exactly.
Okay. Everyone took my comments away from me. So I think people do change over time. If somebody, made some inappropriate, used up their three applications, between 21 and 23, and they got smart at 30. Okay. Report by the Chief of Police.
Well, you passed me this whole meeting, so no, I agree. I think work that's been done here today is great. I think to we're short one. But to put that in perspective, I had an opening when I got here and three retire since, so there's four. But the second opening can't be considered an opening because one of them was a lieutenant. So if and when and how that works, if somebody else is promoted, then we do have another opening. So eventually we will have two openings, if that makes sense. I was confused on that because I kept saying, wait a minute, I had an opening when I got here, three retired. You know, I've had a little bit of calculus. I mean, three plus one is four, and everyone's like, no, you only have retired two. How come I don't have two more? So that's the reason, because they were lieutenants that retired, so are retired. So as we make that promotion, I then have another officer open. So in essence, we will end up hiring once a promotion is made. I assume that that will happen sometime down the road. So I would hire one more officer, and then I would hire another officer to replace position that becomes open as we promote the supervisor. So in essence, we're eventually, I'm going to have to hire two people. Currently, as Amber stated, there is one officer open. So that's what we feel right now.
Okay.
And I think we've already talked about, you know, a possible profile or maybe no profile. As we sat here and talked about this, I think to Kathy's point, we don't want to create a situation where, you know, the chief came up and you had to have that PO. Isn't that amazing that these three have that PO and these three don't? So I don't know how I, you know, we've talked about that. When we get to that point, I think we have to be very careful, maybe just saying experience, then letting the rest of that fall out there and assess it. That might be fair to do it.
And that's also if we can flush out and put together what we think.
So as we talk about that, job description for the possible new sergeant position is being worked on. Kate and Deputy Chief Horn, Matt and Kate talked about that. So that should be a final product here very short. I say final, you know, what the city terms is that. I think so far I'm excited for John Bingham and John Ledbetter. I was excited to, I don't know if you all got to see the city council meeting. They were sworn in. Either
I saw on TV.
The next morning, I actually had someone tell me it was, you know, several people say it was actually awe-inspiring to see the group here that was not happy with the development to sit by and stay because they were grateful for Chief Horn's interaction with them during that. And that was, you know, I was gone that week. Trial by fire,
I appreciated you acknowledging all the officers that were there as well. I mean, that was certainly a compliment to those two officers at Sunday department were in attendance. And that was important.
Yes, I think it shows the morale has been growing, I think, on the department. And I think for all the citizens we can stay there and give us a hand. And of course, I know you all watched it. Song of the Pierre D'Angelo, the one that was in the tree, came up to Chief Horn and thanked him for how his love and handled it to her. And that's also a credit to Morgan's director and Kelly Stinkins' job on that process too. But I think that's important because this commission represents the department. I think it's always nice, and it's not always this way, as we all know, but it's always nice when those individuals stand back on a positive note. So that was. Other than that, we're in good shape. We were moving forward, and Lexapol is coming. We're having that is here at the last set, so we will have best practices and then the policy next to the department. So we're excited that gets rolled out. That's still a approval process, but we're excited about that. I don't have anything else. We've discussed it all.
Cool. Jeff, you getting all dialed in?
Answer.
Don't call me sir. You make me. You do that last time. Make me feel old and useless.
He mentioned this is really my sixth week this week, but the previous 5 weeks the chief has been gone three of them. So
that's how you learn.
That's your report for the commission.
Don't come here, get called in, disappear, and make you stand up to the plate. That whole strategy works. Okay, good. Well, definitely welcome. All dialed in.
I just had one question. Any further on the school resource officer grant funding position?
That is a process that I just called the superintendent, Faith Chapel, and we're talking about that. We're meeting because Jake is kind of the one working on that. So she's talking, going to meet and talk to someone on the school staff, and we're going to meet regularly to see where that's headed. So, you know, it's, I'm excited about it.
And do you think it's a 6 month or a year out?
I will tell you the time frame on an SRO, and that's a good point, Rob, because this would bring another hiring for another office and create another opening. The grant is would be due in the spring of 2015. We put a lot of it together because, you know, we were wondering how quickly it was last fall. So the time frame is, you know, approval from the school side. Once that's done, I've talked to Sean Tepper. He's the grant coordinator for the federal government, the Seattle League, that handles that, gets those approved, looks those over. And so we're looking to do that. That's still in works. But the time frame is, that officer, if that's approved, school approves that, I would immediately request that we create another opening on the department so we can start getting that position filled, because that candidate that would be the SRO would come from within the department. I wouldn't hire a brand new officer to have the job, right? So we would take someone from inside, put them in that position. They would start in September of 2015, and we would need to have, or at least already have, a process for that officer to replace that person, because they would not be on the street.
Okay, so perhaps so interviewing over next summer for a hire in September is what you're, if that works out and it's approved and you're...
You mean it's the SRO position?
Yeah, the existing candidate, your existing officer would move over in September, so you,
yes.
We would need to do interviews next summer to for a replacement on the department at that time.
No, if in the next 3 months, say in December, the school comes to me and says, hey, we want an SRO. I would go to the city right then and ask Doug if we could create another officer position and start getting that person hired, because...
To go through Belia and all.
Yeah, Belia, who knows, if it's a lateral or entry level, that officer may not, even if it's a lateral, let's say that it's a lateral, they've still got that four-month FTO program before they would ever hit the street, so we're already going to be behind the curve. So I would, as soon as I get a yay from the school district, I would immediately ask for an opening position to be created so that we can start that, get that person ready.
Sorry, I'm not part of this. What the SRO is, what exactly are they doing?
School resource officer.
So they are only at the schools?
Yes.
And their role is to, at all the schools on the island?
That would be defined by the school district. I mean, between myself and the superintendent, but that would be something that we would work out. Would that person be primarily at the high school?
Right.
Would the person divide its time between the middle school, high school, and elementary? Are they also there? Should they go to health class?
Right.
There's a myriad number of responsibilities that each community can determine what that SRO functions and how and what the responsibilities are. All that is determined by, in conjunction with school. Okay, so that would be an agreement.
So we've never had anyone in this role before?
We've never had an SRO. Had
okay.
A DARE officer.
Yeah.
We've never had an SRO. An SRO is are federally funded,
right.
75%, and it's for 4 years.
Oh.
And so it's a commitment on everybody's side to have that.
Sounds like a particular individual that would have to be fitted for that as well.
Well, that's the other thing. That person that's hired in that position, the board that would, well, I guess that would come from me.
Yeah.
That's just an assignment, like being a detective or an SRO.
Right.
But internally, we talked about this, that it was the school staff, my staff. And the agreement between both school and police would both have thumbs up, because they don't want somebody they don't want, you know, we don't want somebody that we wouldn't approve. So both would give approval, so we're all happy with who they
can. Well, and that individual's going to be extremely visible to the community.
Oh,
so
yes.
That individual's got to be somebody who's going to put the right face forward, of course, obviously. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah. Okay.
Because we don't want...
Yeah. No, I'm just thinking through it as you were describing it.
Trust me, I thought long and hard, and I've already, in my own mind, looked around and thought it would be a good candidate for someone.
Okay.
Do you have the teenage roundtable? Has that started yet?
Not officially, but yes, we're in the works right now, putting that together. We were at the end of the school year last year with the family youth services, and a lot of seniors wanted to be on it. You know, they were graduating within 8 to 10 weeks. So I put it off till now, but I was excited because I really want to do it. I was hoping the enthusiasm was still there, and it's huge. I got a call from the ASB president. I don't know what that is. The high school. You have each class president, so senior class president. The ASB is what president over all four grades at the high school. He called me last week, week before, and said, "Hey, I'm ready to be on your board. I want to be there." So I was excited because that person carries a lot of influence among his peers at the high school.
And I would think they would be another group that you might want to get some input from as far as this
school. Oh, no, yes. Well, and the site council at the high school includes youth members, parents, and staff members. So that site council is also going through the SRO approval. I mean, they will go through that too. So, but that's handled on, you know, that's school doing. So they are involved that way, but you're absolutely right. I would also use advisory to
Maine. But that's, to me is one of your more exciting things.
Yeah, and I
love that.
And I will tell you, I've got 25 kids now that want to, they're chomping a bit to start. So I'm very excited. Yeah. We're moving forward with that. That's going to be fun. And one of the weeks I was on was with a scout troop. I had to take vacation time, but it was tough.
Now that's how you groom a number two. You just put him in the chair and you disappear and you see if he stands up to the plate.
I had 10 juniors and seniors from Baylor High School all week at the 25 day spot out there.
Okay. Amber, you're up.
Okay. So I talked about some of the items, but let me just make sure I don't miss anything. So kind of going back to Scott, I know I touched on this a little bit when we were discussing the memo that I got requesting candidates be removed. But so Scott has basically given me the guidance that when I receive a memo to remove a candidate from the eligibility list, that I only act on what our automatic disqualifiers are. And that ties into again, the discussion that I had with John, I was talking to him just kind of about our process. He asked how, because it's actually been a while since I've talked to John, and really I think the last time we spoke was right around the time that we were doing our last oral board process. And so he was curious to know how everything worked. And so I was talking about things, and I mentioned, you know, that we had an appeal. I think it was like maybe right around the time when I received the dismissal. So I was, you know, happy about that and kind of talking about the process. And one of the things that he also recommended was that we tighten up the disqualifiers that we have. Basically his guidance was that these should be very specific disqualifiers. So the automatic disqualifiers that we have are very specific, but then we have potential disqualifiers that are a lot more subjective. And I think this also kind of ties into some of the advice that I have gotten from Scott in the past that I've passed along, based on the fact that, like, you know, as an example, one of the potential disqualifiers that we have is, like, you know, unsatisfactory record of employment. And as Scott made clear, that is really not a great reason to disqualify someone. It is a good reason not to hire, but I just want to kind of reiterate that the idea of this rule of three is that when a candidate gets in that position to where their name is given as one of the top three candidates, they have a right to be there, and we need to be careful about how we go about removing the candidates. And the best way to kind of be cautious about that is to have a good tight list of disqualifiers. And again, that kind of ties into things that Scott was saying in the past, that the commission needs to really be in the realm of objectivity, not subjectivity. The subjectivity resides more with the department than it does with the commission. So just, I just wanted to pass along kind of some information.
Any wording recommendations to refine that list?
No, and that's one thing I can talk to him about. One of the things that I was actually hoping will come out of the civil service conference, I think Steve DiGiulio is supposed to be there, and one of the things that John said was that as long as you're that you can, you know, remove people as long as your definitions are clear, which ours are not. So anyway, I want to try to get some information when we're at the conference to try to see if I can make some more sense out of this and get...
Well, what I was going to suggest, we may want to look at this after the conference and
right.
see if we learn something there.
Right.
See if Scott can give us some wording recommendations to tighten up our language. But then, Matt, that's going to have the effect of reducing the number of people that will go off of the list, which is going to put more prerogative on you to handle this list of three. And we'll cut down some of your maneuvering. So we kind of need to make sure we get the right balance.
You're looking at me, so I'm assuming I'm going to comment on this.
Yeah.
The several candidates on the lateral list that we had that did so well, that have done so well, were candidates we couldn't take based on some history. So I think it is imperative that disqualification list be clear, that there's definitions and there's plenty on there. Sunday I was approached by a young man that I know he came to me and said, yeah, I'm going to apply to Bainbridge. He said, I've applied to Seattle, and they told me I should withdraw because they're going to end up disqualifying me, and I won't have to share that with other departments if I just remove myself from the list.
Wow. Really?
So, not a good thing to tell the chief when you're applying. Yeah. I was like, that's nice. But, well, see, I don't see why they point to. But here's what I'm saying. That Seattle person was actually recommending to him to please go ahead and withdraw yourself so we don't have to disqualify you. What that means is now he's going to be in my lateral. Let's just hypothetically say he applies into my lateral pool. He finishes the top. I find out whatever Seattle found out, don't want to hire him either. It would have already been nice if he had been disqualified somewhere else. And if one of your rules had been this individual had been disqualified from the department for a background, I could easily just, not easily, but
yeah,
come back and disqualify him.
Your list well done.
And so that's why I think it's imperative that list is long and comprehensive, because if what you're saying, Amber, and I think we've had a discussion, I was in here when Scott talked about those top three, it's really incumbent upon me to really seriously look at the top three. But if we're not having these automatic disqualifiers here, now I'm stuck with three individuals. Like, I can't have them. Now I got to wait a year to expire off the list or whatever. So.
Yeah, and that's important to us, because if we're looking at laterals for things that they need a good vetting process, again, the best and worst are going to be the laterals. We need to have an adequate vetting process for the worst. They're going to get good recommendations from there.
Like you said before, I know. That's exactly why.
So anyway, so when you say that, that's my thoughts. And when this person told me that, an individual that's not have reluctant to disqualify.
And let's do what feels different. Let's park this one until after the conference with the idea that we'll look to really perfecting that list, and we'll see if we get some good information at the conference, and then we'll solicit some information from Scott, and then I think we'll be prepared to sit down and make a decision.
And whatever you can legally do.
Amber, maybe reach out and get some lists from some other departments as to what they're because
let's
get more examples the better, and then also have the chief, assistant chief, give us some ideas about things that you experienced in the process. You like to see included.
Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, I can give you some reasons.
Yeah, no, it'd be really great.
Amber comes back to me and says, it's not because we've had this conversation.
We have.
Amber looks back at me and
says, let's learn from what we've done already.
Yeah, that's not a disqualification. I'm like, but I would never hire this guy with this history.
But, and that's where the rule of three comes in, is that just you can choose not to hire, but we have to be very careful about how we respond.
Right. So that's why I said that process has to be
good. Let's go there. Good. Yeah. And definitely with Dan's recommendation, let's go that route, and we won't conclude it today, obviously, but let's take a look at it again after the conference and see what we've learned.
And this was more of just like some things that I've stumbled across, not let's take action on them, but just to kind of bring, there are some things I just want to make sure that you are all aware of that I've kind of, like I said, stumbled across over the last month. So that was one. Another recommendation, or at least kind of in talking through our process with John, one of the things that he said we can do to kind of streamline things for when we go through the interview and hiring process is he was kind of asking how we do things, how we got to the point to where we were, and so I explained what our process was. What he said that is common that a lot of departments do is that so PST, when someone takes the written exam through PST, they fill out the personal history questionnaire, a PHQ, and it's like this very long, detailed questionnaire about, you know, all sorts of different elements from their background. And what currently are doing is that, you know, I pull the list, we'll use entry level as an example. So I pull the entry level list for the test scores. You know, I take the top 8 scores, I contact those people. Basically, I go all, you know, as far down the list as I need to get the top 8 people who are available and interested in testing. I schedule the interviews, we have the oral board, I compile all the results, we end up with, you know, the list of scores. We certify the rule of three. All the top 3 candidates go to the chief, and then I provide them, I have been providing them with the personal history questionnaire. And so what John was suggesting was that we could actually use the PHQ in advance of any of this process. So when the chief comes and says, hey, I'd like to have an oral board, and the commission says, okay, we're going to schedule an oral board for whenever, in my process of, you know, going through, making sure that people meet the minimum qualifications, making sure that they have a passing score, finding, you know, those top 8 candidates, that I would then pull the PHQ and look through it. And because we do provide, when the candidates are invited to interview, we provide them with our list of disqualifiers. But they can choose whether or not they want to read that and go, oh yeah, I do have a drug conviction, I'm not going to make it through this process. So if they don't do that, they basically, we're spending the time and the resources to get that person all the way through to the point of the department looking at their PHQ. Whereas if we did it in reverse, and as part of my screening process, I went through their resume, made sure that they meet the minimum qualifications, and then I make sure that their scores are okay. And I then pull the PHQ and look through it and do a precursory examination to see if they have any disqualifiers. We could basically reverse the process and save a lot of time and heartache at the end.
You can integrate this together.
Right.
You can basically put as a disqualifier that you put in the PHQ, and if on their PHQ the following things are there, they're disqualified. So basically you're putting these two issues under the same.
Right, and what she's saying, I'm sure you all caught it, I'm just going to restate, what it does mean, it saves me from getting that individual, that my background investigator finds out that when they do their background, that it doesn't match the PHQ, because that's what's happened on several of these last applicants. They haven't been truthful. They'll say one thing there, and then we find, oh, yeah, I didn't tell you about that. Kind of important. And so she gets to do it up front and then saves it. Those candidates never make it to me. They don't make it to the top 3. So you actually have a cleaner top 3.
Well, if they lie, I mean, there's no way for me to prevent, because I wouldn't be doing a background or vetting anything that they put in the PHQ.
Saying, if something they said on the PHQ was an automatic disqualifier,
right.
It would never.
It would just
something.
Be gone. Right. Yeah, I would contact them. I would talk to them about it.
In the PHQ that prevents it from being used as a vetting document.
Not that I am aware, and you brought up a point that I will need to ask John, because
under disqualifier that they have to have a satisfactory PHQ, and
right.
That the following criteria cannot be evident, or
it,
whatever, you make it, you know, negative or positive.
Make it more defensible than that. If there is no prohibition on the PHQ being used as a vetting document, then we take the PHQ and we vet it right at the beginning, and we make one of our disqualification standards falsification of any of the application documents.
Right.
If we vet the PHQ, assuming we're permitted to do so, and we find a falsification, that pretty much ends the process right there. It gives us a rock-solid disqualifier, a falsification of the document. So say the person has a drug conviction, says no on the PHQ. You know, that's pretty binary. It's, you know, there's not a lot of gray area there.
So we can do both. If on the PHQ they state something that's automatic disqualifier, she sees it, they're off.
Right.
And then
well,
what we
exactly.
could do, we could, as the police department, run a quick criminal history.
Right.
Amber could look at match and go, oh, drug conviction here, and said you didn't have one.
Exactly.
Well, and that part would be actually in your court. At that point, it would be you, and you would then give me the memo saying this person lied, they're disqualified.
You're vetting based on the response on the PHQ.
Right.
You're reaching the same conclusion based on the criminal history, which I say, I don't know, Washington law, I'm assuming Amber's not committed.
So, but you're
we're doing the same thing.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is, we're getting them out before they ever hit the interview.
Exactly. Yeah, I agree with Rich. We save as much time as possible, do as quickly up front.
Exactly. And those don't take long. We can do it.
And that's all predicated on that being a committee to the PhD, which I'm assuming
I would say, John was the one who suggested that use to me, so I can't imagine that there would be any reason not to,
John's an expert in the field, so yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, he said, this is what a lot of places do, and it really helps to streamline the process, so you're not, so we don't end up with a lot of bulk at the end, you know.
I like it. Let's also see if we can perfect that. The only question I have is just the permitted use of the PhD. I can't imagine it not being, but I've always learned the hard way to ask those questions, because when I don't, it's going to get it wrong.
When we have our meeting on disqualifiers, we can look at the PhD and look through it.
Yeah.
And see if there's anything
all
on there.
Of our automatic or potential disqualifiers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, and I can bring copies of what
Yeah, it'd be great for us to be able to look at that.
Yeah, I can send that. I can send that around in advance. Yeah.
Let's move on. We're coming up on 2 hours.
Okay. So, and more will come out after civil service, after the conference, because I will be talking to John about a couple things. So, couple other quick things. The ethics training and Open Public Meetings Act training will be done in October at our regular meeting. So we will have someone here from ethics, and the city attorney, Lisa Marshall, will be here. There is actually a new, I think it's a state requirement for all committees and commissions to receive formal Open Public Meetings Act training. So we'll just kind of get them both here on the same agenda, you know, and it'll kind of similar for those of you who have been through the ethics training or when we've had an ethics person here prior. You'll be able to ask questions. They'll give kind of an overview, and then there'll be some Q&A. So you can expect that at the next meeting. And then Civil Service Conference, everybody's registered. Everyone has hotel accommodations. So we'll see that. We'll see you there. If anybody needs anything prior to departing for that, let me know.
Should we arrange carpets?
Anyone,
Kathy and I are going together.
Anyone have issues or problems with any part of the conference?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Is anyone going to have any problems attending all of the conference?
My ride's happy.
How are we getting
there? As long as you guys don't mind crushed in, goldfish in the back seat, we're okay.
Amber, I'm going to call the hotel. I'm probably going to make a reservation for Sunday night, so I'll mind it.
Okay.
So if you see somehow that shows up in the county bill, set it straight. I'll make sure to get the bill separately.
Okay. Sounds good. Also, a quick update. So I think I mentioned this briefly in our last meeting, but just so you are all aware, I have an incredibly busy schedule outside of the commission for this next month. So I will actually be out at a conference. I leave Saturday and come back on Wednesday. And then basically we'll be heading out to civil service almost right after that. But I just wanted to let you guys know that not that I intend to let anything fall by the wayside here, but just to kind of be aware that I will have some more frequent kind of out of the office. I'll be, taking my laptop and everything to work, while I'm traveling. But I just wanted to let you know, if you have a slight delay, I have some other, basically I'm working on the ICMA. There's an ICMA conference, annual conference is going to be in Seattle next year. And Doug and I are on the host committee for that. So there's a lot of, that's kind of ramping up. So I just wanted to let you know that if there is a slight delay, it's likely due to that, and it's not me, blowing you off, because I do take this very seriously, and
never blow up.
Well, I wouldn't want you to feel that way or to wonder what's going on, because they're kind of separate worlds. I wanted to make sure that you're aware of what's going on in my other world. So that's all. That was the only purpose for that.
So with that busy schedule in mind, do you have some suggestions for setting that next? Your availability and ability to get things we need for that next special meeting for an executive session on creating additional test banks then?
No, I'll make it happen. I mean, if I thought there was something, I would have said something about that. It's not about that I don't think I'll be able to get the work done, and I certainly will carve out time for, if we need to do a panel or two panels or whatever, I make myself available. It's just more like most of my job, I'm outside of Doug's office. However, there are a lot of things that are coming up where I will be traveling a lot away from my you know, most people are like administrative, they're at their desk. I will be away from my desk for a large part of the next couple of months and just wanted you to be aware of that. There are no bandwidth issues that should come up or anything like that. I will make the time to make this a priority. It was just more of like a, just information.
Okay, well, good luck. Yeah, I think my information needs have all been met just through email. Returning real quick, just so we're diligent to public comment, we still have no members of the public. So we are at end of agenda. Any going on the table just once, any final issues before we adjourn?
I request that our special meeting not be on Monday or Friday. Really difficult.
I concur.
Okay. Monday and Friday, we want to knock off the bridge.
Monday and Fridays, that's fine. No issues. I'm thinking just another Tuesday, almost the same block of time between now and the next meeting.
Okay. It seems to work very well. I mean, I think all of our special meetings have been on a Tuesday at 9, so I'll do a quick poll and find some times that work and get that set up. So
my only time crunch is going to be the third Tuesday of each month after the county commission, and I've got to go back to Los Angeles the week after our civil service conference. That'll be a one-week trip.
Okay.
All right, Dan?
I'm fine. No, it's just good to see what the dates are, and I'll be able to determine from that. So, okay. I agree with everybody else.
Yeah. Sure. Chief?
Good.
Amber?
Nope.
We are adjourned.
All right.
Chief, I know you've made a compliment.
Okay. It's always good.